From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we listen back to our latest Across the Divide forum in partnership with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's a progress report on Foxconn, from the politics of it.
Well, I mean, obviously, if you're Governor Scott Walker, you're running as a pro-Foxconn candidate. I mean, you are joined at the hip to this announcement, you know, for both good and ill.
To the business angle.
Foxconn will be trying to enter markets that are either new or just developing or that we don't even have not even imagined yet.
To remaining environmental questions.
You know, people were told that Foxconn is committed to being a good neighbor, to tending to the environment, but there was no one from the company there to speak to them to answer questions. And a lot of people would have liked to have heard that.
Across the Divide, our Foxconn forum is next on Lake Effect, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. 7 months ago, we convened a panel to discuss initial questions about the Foxconn project. Since then, developments have happened at a breathtaking pace. The official groundbreaking for the facility will be on Thursday. The first $100 million in construction contracts have been announced, with most of that going to Wisconsin companies, and some are asking how political connections affected those awards. That's one question we sought to answer in a follow-up forum. We returned to the Prairie School in Wind Point and convened a reporter roundtable to discuss the latest Foxconn developments. We were joined by Journal Sentinel business reporter Rick Rommel, who has been covering the Foxconn story since day one. Also with us was WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz, who has studied Foxconn's potential water use and its future impact on air quality. And we also had Jason Stein, who covered politics related to Foxconn as a state capitol reporter. His new role is as the research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Our moderators were the Journal Sentinel's Aaron Richards and Lake Effect's Mitch Teich, who began by asking Jason Stein about the political pros and cons of the project for Governor Scott Walker.
You know, I think the first thing when you're talking about an election that is 6 months away, I think the first thing to do is to be honest about what you don't know. And so, you know, in this case right now, you know, I just wrote down a few of those things, but, you know, we don't know how the pace of work will happen, you know, in terms of building this plant, employing people there, starting to make products. We don't know, you know, whether any of the litigation and disputes over environmental permits might hold up that plant. We don't know if suppliers, for instance, may announce new plants and jobs in Wisconsin, or Foxconn has also talked about other locations in Wisconsin. You know, we don't know if any of that gets announced over the next 3, 4, 5 months. So with that caveat, you know, obviously this, I think Foxconn has been a mixed bag, especially at the statewide level. Obviously, when you look at the polling, it's a little bit more popular. In generally in the Racine, southeastern Wisconsin area, statewide, it certainly is something that if you look at the Democratic primary for governor, you know, the candidates are really jumping over one another to bring out some criticism of the project. It'll be interesting to see how much that carries forward into the general election, which will be on us before we know it.
So more specifically, Jason, what are the perils of running as a pro-Foxconn candidate or an anti-Foxconn candidate? Like, can you just kind of talk us through what some of those nuances would be?
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously, if you're Governor Scott Walker, you're running as a pro-Foxconn candidate. I mean, you are joined at the hip to this announcement, you know, for both good and ill, you know, as a politician. And, you know, I think he legitimately believes in what he's negotiated. What you see, I mean, it's been very clear that almost from the beginning, the Democratic candidates for governor have been pretty critical. You had Andy Gronick, a Milwaukee businessman, for a hot minute said some praiseworthy things of the you know, of the deal, and then, you know, thought better about it. I mean, I think, look, I mean, on the one hand, we have 13,000 jobs that are possible here. On the other hand, we have, you know, $3 billion at the state and another, you know, billion roughly at the local level that are going to pay for that. So, I mean, that in a nutshell is the pro and con of it that people are going to have to grapple with as voters.
Would you imagine that geography is going to play a large role? Like,
absolutely,
the further from Racine you get, the less...
Absolutely. And, you know, and you saw that in, you know, Corey Mason, who ran and won as the new mayor of Racine, obviously did that as a Democratic assemblyman who voted for the deal, you know, and obviously did not pay a price at all for that, right? On the other hand, you had the people in the legislature that are running for governor, like Dana Walks and Kathleen Vinehout, the Democrats, were very pointedly voted against it. So, and I don't think as politicians, they're probably wrong, at least when they're looking up, when they're thinking about the Democratic primary, which is their first hurdle.
And Jason, you know, you and I were talking a little bit last night about how the calculus would change if a Democrat actually wins the governor's seat, and the Republicans still control both houses of the legislature. What, if anything, could that do to Foxconn, or would it really require the Senate to flip Democratic as well?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, the state has signed a contract with Foxconn, and government can't abrogate contracts. Now, sometimes government can make a company think twice about whether they really want to push forward with the contract, because, you know, Foxconn will have made some steps, but by November, they won't necessarily be in a position where they couldn't make another decision. And in fact, you've seen that they have done that in other parts of the world. So, I mean, I think the Democratic candidates for governor have said that they would really aggressively reopen this issue. And I think you should take a politician at face value, at least take into account what they say when they're on the campaign trail.
Well, and maybe this is where it bleeds over with Susan's expertise, because regardless of where the Senate is or where the legislature in general is, at the regulatory level, the governor can certainly put people into office who can either fight or defend lawsuits from an environmental standpoint.
That's true, and you know, we've seen from the beginning of the Foxconn bill, even before we moved into the permitting process, that that foundation was laid for a streamlined process. The wetlands issue was sort of set aside. Don't worry, you can impact those wetlands, and you can offset in other places. So certainly, you know, there is food for lawsuits that could occur.
I think we could probably bring Rick into this a little bit too. You know, we're talking a little bit about politics, and this entire project is intertwined with politics. We just learned we knew two companies already were going to have some construction contracts here. Now we know 25 more. Most of them are Wisconsin companies. Some critics are saying, look, the people that got these contracts are people that have contributed to the governor's campaign and GOP in general. Is there any merit to the awarding of contracts based on political spending?
Again, thank you from me as well for inviting me here. It's very interesting and a privilege. I don't know about pay for play being involved here, but I can tell you that when 27 of the first 28 subcontracts awarded are all for Wisconsin companies, go to Wisconsin companies, I mean, that's a far greater percentage than Foxconn is going to be obligated or has set as a goal in its contract awards. So this is total speculation, but is it an accident that the first set of subcontracts, which are going to get a lot of attention, are overwhelmingly given to Wisconsin companies? Arguably, no. Nor do I think it's an accident that there was a sort of a tour across Wisconsin by Governor Walker as these contracts were announced, from Black River Falls for Hoffman Construction, Brownsville, Michaels Corporation, and then with Case down here in Racine. In other words, the whole state's involved, and we're all going to benefit from this. That's the message, I think.
One of the issues that came up in our forum 6 months ago was that there were so many more questions than there were answers, and there was little that we had heard from Foxconn itself. Have the last 6 months produced any more transparency in the process?
Not a heck of a lot, Mitch. for one thing, Foxconn they're based in Taiwan. They have had very limited operations in the United States up till now. They have a way of doing business that's I'm sure they're well set in, and it's a huge company, $135 billion in revenue last year. It's not that things haven't gotten better. They have gotten a lot better. But the company is still fairly closed-mouthed, I'd say, about what they're doing.
I mean, you can certainly say that. I mean, as a journalist, as a former journalist, I'm still working on that. Today is my
still first, writing 2017 today, on your checks,
yeah,
too, right?
8:15 was my first report to duty in my new job today. So I'm still waiting for all the knowledge to descend on me as a research director now. But you know, I spent many days looking through thousands of pages of open records that were released about the contracting process and so forth. So we certainly got a lot of information. I mean, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that we can now predict the future about, you know, what this company's going to do, how it's going to perform in the marketplace, whether these liquid crystal displays are going to sell, you know, a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. You know, so that's sort of the difficult thing as the public and as journalists, that you want to know everything up front, and you can't, and a lot of things are not knowable.
Can I jump back in just for a second? You know, part of it is the company is so large and this project is so vast that the number of questions that we have is enormous. But I will say that on the Foxconn being more open score, they have made available Louis Wu, who's special assistant to Terry Goh, the chairman of Foxconn. And I mean, he takes questions, he answers them. He spoke with me for a sit-down interview. I know he spoke with Mick Burke of the Racine Journal Times. Very, you know, not completely, but at some length about, you know, his vision for what the company wants to do with this plant. So yeah, there's progress being made on that front.
And I would also say on the environmental front, you know, as the process of permitting has gone through, when there was discussions and it drew many, many people to talk about the diversion of Lake Michigan water to serve the plant, you know, people were told that Foxconn is committed to being a good neighbor, to tending to the environment, but there was no one from the company there to speak to them, to answer questions. And a lot of people would have liked to have heard that.
That was WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz in part one of our Across the Divide forum on Foxconn. We'll have more of our recording after a short break, so stay tuned. You're listening to Lake Effect from 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Let's get back to our Across the Divide reporter roundtable on Foxconn, recorded in May at the Prairie School at Wind Point. Our moderators were Mitch Tyke and Aaron Richards, and our panelists were Jason Stein, Susan Bentz, and Rick Rimmel, who talked about the projected job mix at the new factory.
I find this very interesting, and I mean, the bottom line is we really don't know what it's going to be like. And Foxconn's approach has changed markedly over the last 12 months. Initially in May of 2017, before they had selected a site in Racine County or Wisconsin for that matter, they envisioned almost two-thirds of the jobs being, I would say, you know, basic factory production work. Folks with a high school education, perhaps more, but not necessarily more. Since then, according to Louis Wu, Foxconn has sort of flipped its approach, and now he's talking about like two-thirds of the workforce being what he calls knowledge workers. But that still leaves a third, which, you know, could be 4,000 some jobs for people who are going to be doing basic production work and would not necessarily require special skills. I personally think that's a real opportunity for a lot of people in southeastern Wisconsin, certainly people in Milwaukee. We're talking about these jobs would average $23 an hour. You know, it's tough to find something like that with a high school education.
Yeah, and I would say Rick had a really good story in Sunday's paper, right? About
yeah, right,
that.
Right.
I would urge you to read it if you haven't
read it.
That's
why I remember this so well.
But I think it's worth noting, as you know, the company has put out certain, you know, fairly precise estimates of, you know, we think that the average wage the plant will be 52 or 53,000. And one of the things I was really struck by, though, is the degree to which, you know, this occupational mix is in flux within the plant. And then to sort of think about, well, if you have that much of a difference in terms of who may be working there, how well can you estimate what you're going to be paying them? And that's one of the things that I'd like to talk to the company more about and the state more about, you know, in the coming weeks and months.
You were talking, this is another question from the audience, you were talking about the potential for the factory to draw on employees from Milwaukee, and we talk about people coming up from, you know, Kenosha and points to the south. With the increase in traffic, what do we know about the potential or the expansion of the interstates in each direction, and who's paying for that expansion?
I can chime in on that. It's going on right now. I mean, they a few months ago they started with the frontage road work. The I-94 is being expanded to four lanes each direction from Highway 142 in Kenosha County north to roughly College Avenue in Milwaukee. So it'll be four lanes all the way from the Mitchell Airport interchange down to the state line. And who's paying for it? I think we are still waiting to find out whether we're going to get a federal grant worth something like $250 million, which is not a slam dunk. I mean, you'd think that Wisconsin would have the upper hand in getting this money, but it would amount to, I think, 1/6 of this pool of federal money in this particular program, which is a lot for one project. Now, we have a project that is supported by the White House that is important to the president as well as to Wisconsin officials. So my guess is, yeah, we're going to get that money. But that's $250 million federal, $250 million from the state, roughly. That's where it comes from.
Well, and obviously it's us. I mean, you know, in some way, shape, or form. I mean, I don't need to tell the audience that I-94 North-South project has been, you know, much delayed over the years, and you know it will be delayed even more if we don't get that federal money. And obviously, the state has policymakers, elected officials have struggled in recent years to come to terms with how the state is going to be able to find the money to pay for the state's share of projects like that one. Now, obviously, you know, as long as this governor is in office, I think they'll be prioritizing that project. But it, you know, that the struggle remains real for all those things.
There's an audience question about whether the component is it true that Foxconn only committed to hiring 10% minorities for the jobs that are available?
But that's my understanding.
Okay. And do you know if that's high or low compared to other companies in terms of commitments?
I don't, but I guess, you know, that's 1,300 jobs, so the raw number is pretty high. I can't compare it to anything else.
Part of the question, I think, is going to be, is there adequate transportation? Is there adequate training? Are there other adequate support services so that, you know, some of the populations in the state in southeastern Wisconsin that really need jobs can take full advantage of this? And it's not a purely a charitable exercise either, in that, you know, with the state is under 3% unemployment, and you know, if we tasked everybody in this room to go out and find 13,000 jobs, you know, by the end of the month, I think we would discover that it's not an easy task to find those workers. So
We're getting lots of questions in. I wanted to ask maybe Rick to reflect on this. Can you compare the full court press on Foxconn to the effort to attract Amazon's HQ2?
I don't know a lot about the Amazon effort other than that every city in the country wants it. I was just reading a commentator, I think it's Tim Bartik, he's an economist with the Upjohn Institute in Michigan, seeing that the incentives that have been offered to Amazon proportionately are actually less than the incentives that Wisconsin has offered to Foxconn. I don't know about Amazon. Wisconsin's effort was vigorous. Very vigorous.
It's interesting because Wisconsin was up against, what, two or three other states from a serious standpoint? Four or five. But the Amazon HQ2 project, I mean, we're talking about dozens of cities that that have been in the running for that. And, you know, I wonder what makes that such a more desirable development than...
Well, it's more jobs, for one thing.
It is a corporate headquarters, which, again, that is a little bit of a different animal. It also is obviously, there are high-tech elements to the Foxconn plant, but I think as Rick just explained, I mean, there are also people that are going to be putting TVs in boxes, you know? I mean, that's part of the deal. Whereas, obviously, Amazon is a company that is particularly in the corporate headquarters, you are going to have, you know, a real collection of knowledge workers. And not to say that there won't be in Mount Pleasant either, but I mean, you know, that there is obviously that aspect to it that's a little different. You know, if Foxconn had been talking about moving from Taiwan, and moving the whole shebang here, that would have changed the conversation too. So
Lee Stedman from Waterford had a good question about whether there are any other permits that Foxconn technically needs to complete any of their construction or actually move into the manufacturing mode. Is there anything else they still need?
They I just have to complete a stormwater management plan, which the DNR says comes when, I mean, they've got an initial letter of intent from them, from the company, and as they get close to the point of production, of opening up shop, then they would review it.
And on that same front, can you talk, Susan, just a little bit about the lawsuit that was filed by the Illinois Attorney General against the for the air pollution part of Racine getting, you know, waived from the federal EPA's designation as a high smog area, so Foxconn doesn't have to?
I haven't covered that lawsuit yet, but the point that you're making is that the EPA was needed to make a determination if Racine County was compliant or, you know, fell within the ozone standards, and that decision came from the EPA saying yes, indeed it does. That and of course that would make, you know, Illinois angry because they're being told, okay, it's because of you that Racine has this ozone issue, and certainly, for instance, Foxconn is a large manufacturer, will contribute to that, but the EPA is saying, they're taking that, making that a much diminished situation with that decision. So I'm sure there will be discussion, and there'll probably be people in the state of Wisconsin who will be battling that as well.
Fiona from Racine wrote in a pretty, I think, a thought-provoking question here. She writes, with existing mental health resources already stretched and failing to bridge critical gaps in Southeast Wisconsin communities, are there any plans in place at a state level to increase funding for programs that would address mental health needs of not just Foxconn workers, but the families who will relocate with them and the children who will enroll in area schools? And I think this speaks to, you know, all sorts of community services that stand to be taxed beyond what they have to accomplish. Now, what do we know about how municipalities and, you know, government or intergovernmental or nonprofit agencies are preparing for what's sure to come with the influx of so many workers and their families?
Sure. So when we say that Foxconn carries a price tag of roughly $4 billion, we're not factoring in things like that. So to explain it, I mean, what that's talking about is the tax credits that will be paid out to the company, the highway project that Rick mentioned, the borrowing that's going to be done by the local government to help provide, you know, infrastructure for the plant and, you know, the surrounding environs. But what we're not talking about is, you know, to the extent that this does attract thousands more people, you know, to the communities around the area, that estimate doesn't include, you know, the costs that school districts might have if they need to build a school or if they just simply need to staff up schools. It doesn't necessarily take into account all those sort of ancillary costs that happen. Now, I mean, it's not necessarily a tragedy, right? When a school district gets more students show up, and you know they're maybe able to be a little bit more efficient because you know they do have kindergarten right now, but there will be costs to that. There will be mental health, sure, all those things. There will be costs, and they aren't necessarily factored in to the numbers that you might see in your local news report or newspaper.
And do we know what the multiplier effect is? What the numbers we're talking are?
Well, again, I mean, you know, we've talked about Foxconn bringing up to 13,000 jobs. We've talked about suppliers and other companies, you know, bringing up into the 22,000 range, which, you know, that might be half of that. But then again, you know, those workers are going to have families, you know, spouses, children, that sorts of things. So no, I mean, we have not seen estimates on how that impacts a community. And it would be worth, you know, I mean, if you were in a policy group and you were a research director, maybe you should look into that sort of thing.
Good idea. I think it's that arguably there are going to be some pretty substantial impacts as people move to the area for these jobs. Again, just was reading today a study, you know, it's one economist, but a pretty well-respected one, estimates that incentive programs where a state, generically speaking, provides incentives for a company to increase employment, that over the long run, the total span of the incentives, that maybe 80% of the jobs end up being taken by people who didn't originally live in the area when the incentives were created. Now, that's all I know about it. I don't know whether there's research that contradicts that. But the number of unemployed people in Racine County who are in the labor force, you know, ready to work, willing to work, I think it's less than 4,000 right now, and that's dropped from 8,000 or 9,000, more than 10,000 a few years ago. The number in metropolitan Milwaukee, the four county area, Milwaukee, Waukesha, Washington, Ozaukee counties, 26,000, and that's down from close to 70,000 5 years ago. You know, there's unemployment 3.1% in metro Milwaukee, 3.7% in Racine. There's not that much give here, and which is opportunity for other people to come in. Maybe that's a good thing. Growth is generally considered to be a positive economic attribute for a community, but there are going to be costs.
So as much as we've talked about Foxconn, there's a number of questions from audience members that are actually curious about what exactly this factory is making other than TV screens.
Good question.
who can answer that?
Let me look it up
in real quickly, because this is something I'm very interested in, and I can tell you when I spoke with Lewis Wu about a month ago, he said that initially we're going to start out making television sets, assembling television sets to begin with, because they won't have the glass, this sophisticated thin glass and gigantic sheets that ultimately will be sited here. They won't have that at first, so they'll be importing components, putting the TV sets together, and that's what they'll be doing at first. But he also talks about that, like, very reluctantly. You know, this isn't what we want to be doing. We don't want to be a TV set manufacturer. We want to make gigantic, ultra-high definition resolution panels for doctors to use in surgery, for security purposes, for automating factories, for use in driverless vehicles. I don't know what all the markets are for these types of uses right now. I think that they're just developing, and it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, and I think it's worth noting that these ultra-high definition liquid crystal display panels that Rick is talking about, they get referred to as 8K, which it's just a technical jargon, but it just refers to the number of pixels they have. But you know, that's a level of definition that you don't see in commercial televisions.
It's 16 times what your TV at home.
Right. So that even if you bought it and you hooked it up, your cable wouldn't necessarily right now provide you an image, you know, content at a kind of quality to take advantage of that. It'd be like driving a Formula One race car around your neighborhood. You know, you're not able to get the thing to its full.
You could brag about it, though.
Right. Well, you could. And, you know, that's an underrated aspect of why people buy things. But, yeah, but that at least gives you a sense.
Well, and so at some level, do you think there's a concern at Foxconn or among the people who have brought Foxconn here that for the indefinite future they might be putting together TV sets? I mean, is that
I don't think they're worried about it. Foxconn is all in on this 8K stuff. They've got a plant that's going to be similar to the one in Mount Pleasant that they're building in China right now. They bought Sharp Corporation, which has a similar plant in Osaka, Japan, and this is, I think they want to stake a lot of their future business on this this technology.
And they're a smart company, and they make generally very good decisions. They've gotten involved with the iPhone. You may have heard of it. But obviously, there are also companies that do things like Blu-ray, and you know, they don't pan out. So that's, I mean, it's worth noting that not every technology road is a thoroughfare. Some of them are dead ends sometimes.
I hate to dance too far into the what-if type questions, but there are some questions from the audience about if the technology changes, does this whole plant get demolished? Is it, you know, like a Kodak pulling out of a, you know, town in New York? I mean, is there concern that the technology changes so much that this thing just goes away?
Okay. That was one of the first questions, sort of general questions, I remember being raised like back in July when it looked like we were going to get this plant. And the response was, hey, Foxconn, Terry Goh and Foxconn, son of a policeman, you know, self-made man. He started out making, I don't know if it was knobs, plastic knobs for Atari video games or something like that. It was, and then got into knobs for television sets. You know, the company has evolved incredibly over the 40, 50 years it's been in business. They have something like 55,000 patents. Yeah, things are going to change, but they look like they can roll with it.
Rick Rommel closes out part two of our Across the Divide forum on Foxconn. We'll take one last break and then return with a final segment on Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. We're listening today to a reporter roundtable, part of our Across the Divide series with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The topic is Foxconn and the development already under construction in Racine County, with its official groundbreaking ceremony to take place this Thursday. Our moderators were Mitch Tyke and Aaron Richards, and our panelists were Rick Rommel, Jason Stein, and Susan Bentz. Bentz addressed the potential net loss of 2.7 million gallons of Lake Michigan water each day once the factory comes online and how it might compare to similar losses in the past.
I would think that in the history of manufacturing in Wisconsin, there would have been, you know, quite a different story before we had, you know, regulations that took care of the water issue. The water utility manager at Racine told me in the early days, the utility was cleaning up a lot of polluted water, you know, when there weren't regulations there to manage it. So in the conversation, that return didn't seem to be the main issue. It was, is this setting a precedent? Is this water that should be used for, you know, this kind of a plant? And, you know, again, what could it mean for future applications? How easy is it going to become?
I don't think that the amount of water that's consumed, the 2.7 million gallons a day, it sounds like a huge amount. It is. Lake Michigan, and technically Lake Michigan and Lake Huron are the same lake. They rise and fall at the same time. In that context, it is an absolutely minuscule amount.
I mean, I think there's a couple ways to think about it. One, it's definitely true that there was not a Great Lakes Water Compact, you know, until very recently. In the heyday of Racine manufacturing, you know, the community did, you know, the kinds of plants that existed in Sinkerator and Case and some of these plants did use more water than they're using now. And that's one reason why Racine was able to get this project, is because they had this excess capacity within their larger system that not every community would have. So in that sense, it's not necessarily more water than the community was drawing at points in its past. I mean, that doesn't mean, though, when you say it seems like a lot of water, it is a lot of water. So, you know, and that's the two sides of it.
Jason, do you think, does this forever up the ante for state incentives packages? Does every company that's thinking of coming to Wisconsin look at what the state gave to Foxconn and say, well, if you can do it for them, why can't you do it for us?
Well, there's that possibility, sure. I mean, you know, that's why we hold elections and, do all those things. I think what you can see is with Kimberly-Clark, so you all may have heard that Kimberly-Clark, the paper maker, was looking at closing down two plants in, up in the Fox Valleys area. And Governor Walker actually offered them the same deal in terms of the incentive levels per job and per dollar of capital investment that Foxconn is getting. And Foxconn's deal is to be very clear, it's an unprecedented deal. It's the governor has argued that it makes sense because the company, he believes, has a lot of promise, but it is not a deal that we've offered somebody before. And then, you know, in relatively short order, we've also made that deal to Kimberly-Clark, or offered that. Now, the legislation to enable that failed to pass the legislature, but in part that was because Kimberly-Clark has never come back and said to the state, yeah, we want it, no, we don't. So, you know, if they came back tomorrow and said, hey, we'll keep our plants here if you give us this deal, I think there's a very good chance that the legislature would come back in special session and pass it. So, I mean, I think my long-winded answer there is that it does seem to have put some upward pressure on state subsidies.
Does the Foxconn project have an opportunity to drive innovation among other businesses in Wisconsin? You've written about, you know, startups in the Wisconsin region. I mean, is there an opportunity here for a lot more innovation to be spurred statewide or even in the region as a result of Foxconn?
And somebody also asked you whether there's an impact on like UW research, whether academia might somehow take a lead from this as well.
Again, I'm just sort of theorizing. I would think absolutely there's that opportunity. It's an entirely new sort of industry. Foxconn will be trying to enter markets that are either new or just developing or that we don't even have not even imagined yet. That has to spur smart people, tech-oriented people to start thinking about applications that they can develop. And similarly with academic researchers. I have no firsthand knowledge of this. I think it just stands to reason that that's definitely a possibility.
I mean, obviously Terry Goh's people have met with researchers at the UW, and not necessarily entirely in just the realm of manufacturing and screens. He lost his first wife to cancer and has been involved in a lot of philanthropy around cancer research in Taiwan. And there's some connections between people that do that work in Taiwan and the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And so there were some initial discussions back before the award was even announced that the factory was coming here. So, you know, that's one of the things when I said earlier, we don't know all the announcements that might come. It's certainly possible that you could see Terry Gao endow some sort of cancer research at the University of Wisconsin. It's possible.
In all the reporting that the three of you have done, what's your sense for the divide on who's excited and who is really concerned about this project, where that divide lines? You know, I get the sense from a lot of the questions that we've taken from the audience that there's some real concerns at a variety of levels. You know, what do you know about who the excited players are and who's looking at this with either a sense of dread or certainly, you know, grave concern?
I do think, and I'm sure Susan can speak on this in depth, that there are folks with environmental concerns that are totally based off their view of what should happen to the environment. That said, I seem to sense a political angle in just about everything else that in some of the environmental concerns as well. You know, so that it gets hard to tell whether when someone is criticizing, when someone is lauding, are they doing it because on the merits of their argument, or are they doing it because I stand with Scott Walker or I want to stick it to Scott Walker? To me, that seems pervasive.
What I found, especially when going out to hearings, it stood out primarily because so many people who testified were citizens from, and some came from all parts of the state when it came to the water issue, in particular to that water diversion. And those who spoke in support were generally, I have to make sure that I remember correctly, were local and regional you know, elected officials or economic development people, and understandably so. I mean, you can see where that divide comes, but it was striking.
Revisiting the question about why Foxconn decided to locate here when labor is so cheap in Asia, why not just keep all your operations over there and continue to make money from that part of the world?
Well, I think it bears saying that they've are keeping the vast majority of it over there right now. I mean, obviously, you know, we live in a world where protectionism in our politics is a recurring theme. And, you know, when the president put tariffs on China, was Terry Gou feeling bad about his decision to locate this plant here? I would guess on that day he felt good about his decision to locate a plant here. So that's part of it. Obviously, in Wisconsin, if you're a manufacturer, you pay virtually no personal income or corporate income taxes on the profits from that manufacturing. That's not a bad deal if you're in that line of work. So, there's just a couple examples there.
I'm not sure what the business case is for making large display panels in the United States. We're going to find out. I can, and I'm not saying this is what happened, but I can definitely see a political case made advanced for doing this in the United States based on President Trump's election, the noise he was making about protecting American industry and perhaps raising tariffs. And you've got a company that does 50%, more than 50% of its revenue comes from Apple. Which is based in the United States, that's a huge, it's of paramount importance to Foxconn. Would I be willing to, make an investment in this country where the newly elected president is talking about throwing tariffs up? Would I be willing to make an investment to protect my much, much larger business? I think it's definitely arguable.
We have another question, and this one is about power use. Do we know whether the capacity of, say, the Oak Creek power plant and other power sources in the area is enough to power this factory without necessarily taxing what it's already providing elsewhere?
Well, they're building that.
Yeah, exactly.
ATC is building this gigantic substation. Say substation seems sort of dismissive. It's going to be huge.
And there's obviously that is part of the cost to the larger public of this plant, in that there is a cost to ratepayers that is going to be borne. You know, everybody is going to pay a tiny bit more on their utility bill to help make that happen. And I'm blanking on it. I
for the next 40 years or something.
Right. Yeah, right.
But it's like 3 cents a year.
Right. But it's tens of millions.
It is a cost. It's $140 million.
Yeah, $140 million. So it's, you know, now no one's going to pay more than a tiny portion of that, but it's a significant cost that is being borne by the public for the project.
Correct.
This question has come up so many times, so I just have to ask it again for your thoughts. A lot of people in this audience or watching from home really want to know if there's any way to ensure that more of these jobs actually go to local residents, whether that means Racine local or right in this area or Wisconsin residents. Is there any way for the public to put pressure on the company to do that? I mean, the contract has already been sort of put together. So is there anything that residents can do if they want to see that guarantee or that commitment be made?
I mean, I think it's as much about, I don't think the company is going to be in a position to turn away qualified workers. I think it's as much about making sure that local and state elected officials provide ways for people to get the training they need, the transportation they need, the support they need to show up at the doors of this factory. So, I think it's not as simple as just saying to Foxconn, well, just go hire somebody. Because, I mean, that is what they're going to be doing, I think. But if people can't get there, well, then it's not going to work. So.
Why would Foxconn want to create headaches for itself by not embracing available local workers? It's just they're here now. The company realizes that this is an issue of some sensitivity. There's no reason for them not to hire local people if they're qualified and if they're available.
We hear a lot about the supply chain effect and the potential impact on the supply chain in the area. Have there already been spinoffs related to Foxconn that have been announced at this point?
Well, I mean, with regard to the construction, so we talked a little bit about that. There's been some discussion. I think the first sort of domino to fall on this is the Corning Glass company, which a very talented colleague from the Journal Sentinel helped me write a story about that. It was basically my last story for the Journal Sentinel was about this.
Glad to participate.
Yeah. there's been some talk going back and forth about this Corning Glass company that's going to supply the main component of these screens, saying that they would only locate here if somebody else would pay 2/3 of their costs to build the plant and that they could keep 100% of the revenues and profits, which seems like a pretty good deal. In sort of going back with the state, they did not initially volunteer this, but over the course of the reporting, they came out with this, that the head of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corp told us that, yeah, that's not going to be us. That's not going to be you. That's going to have to be something that Corning and Foxconn work out between themselves. So, but anyway, that's like one of the issues that we'll have to see too, is we sort of hinge this whole thing on being able to attract thousands of jobs from suppliers, but there's also going to be that push and pull of, you know, is Northern Illinois going to poach some of those companies, or are we going to be able to, you know, get them also to locate in Wisconsin?
Our Across the Divide series is produced with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The Foxconn Forum, Your Questions, Our Answers, was moderated by Mitch Tyke and Aaron Richards and featured Rick Rimmel, Susan Bentz, and Jason Stein as our panelists. The Prairie School in Wind Point hosted the event. We have time today to close out the show with a song from singer-songwriter Joe Richter. He stopped by the Lake Effect Performance Studio ahead of his show at Summerfest this weekend and shared this tune called Lucky Man.
I got a girl and a lover, old soul. We've been together a while and I met her some years ago. Sometimes I stop to think and it's clear to see. God made an angel and he gave her to me. Yes, God made an angel and he gave her to me. I'm a lucky man, yeah. I am a lucky man. I'm a lucky man, yeah. I am a lucky man. Coming from a place that I was years ago, you might have thought a guy like me live alone. But when the old man asked me to sing and play, well, the angel was standing right in front of me. Yeah, the angel was standing right in front of me. I'm a lucky man. Time I dreamed of a life so bliss. Belief in a God brought me love and happiness. And having a good woman in my life fills the void of happiness and love inside. Fills the void and happiness and love inside.
Lucky Man, performed by musician Joe Richter, was recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio and engineered by Jason Reeby. You'll be able to hear his full interview later this week. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned, it's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.
I am a lucky man.